Welcome to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast.
Each week we'll be joined by a guest or two to discuss the law, how politicians are improving it or screwing it up, and what it all means for our increasingly battered, unwritten constitution.
We're hoping to be entertaining as well as serious, and we're definitely not going to be an echo chamber. All ideas are welcome here. I'm Ken McDonald, the former Director of Public Prosecutions and a criminal barrister at Matrix Chambers.
And I'm Tim Owen, also a barrister at Matrix Chambers, specialising in crime, public law and human rights law.
In this first episode, Tim and I are joined by the former head of the Government Legal Service, Sir Jonathan Jones, QC. Jonathan resigned from his position in September 2020 in protest at the government's plan to revisit the special Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland through the UK Internal Market Bill, a plan that Jonathan viewed as a deliberate breach of international law. He subsequently joined the international law firm Linklaters as a senior consultant. Tim and I thought Jonathan would be the ideal person to discuss how governments take legal advice, the ethics of ignoring it, and the role of the law officers.
We recorded our interview with Jonathan just before the implosion of the Johnson government, but what he has to say has continuing relevance and importance for whoever holds the office of Prime Minister and whoever has the job of advising the government on lawmaking and law breaking.
Welcome to Double Jeopardy with me, Ken McDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen.
And we're delighted that, really delighted that our guest this week is Jonathan Jones, the former head of the Government Legal Service, who resigned a few months ago. And we'll probably get on to talking about that, Jonathan, in due course. I first met Jonathan when he became chief legal advisor to the law officers when I was DPP, and that must have been back in about 2004 or five that you took over that job, Jonathan. And I always very much enjoyed working with you. I didn't necessarily always have the easiest relationships with the attorneys general, but I always had a very good relationship with Jonathan. I'm delighted you're here today to talk to us, Jonathan.
Well, thank you very much. And by the way, it was almost 2 years since I resigned from government. So time has flown in some ways and not in others. But anyway, thank you very much for having me.
Well, time has flown, and I'm sure you've been, well, we have all sorely missed you in that job, which is obviously a very important one, has been an important one, and probably quite a difficult one in recent times. And we're going to get into some of that, I hope. Jonathan, can we start by talking a bit about your background, where you're from, where you were brought up, what first interested you in a legal career?
So I came from a large family. I've got five siblings in rural Wales, and I went to school in Wales. None of my family had any background in the law or the civil service, although my father had worked for local government. And I mean, it all feels a very long time ago now, if I'm honest, but I think the law as a kind of discipline and exercise in solving problems, intellectually interesting, but also something that affected people's real lives in ways I later got to know much more about. And that combination between law and policy and governance later on became, I suppose, what really gripped me in government. So as is often the way, I kind of wandered only with a very vague idea into what I was getting into. But I'm glad I did. And I read law at Durham, which was a great time. And I'm now very happy to be visiting professor at Durham. And occasionally even physically visiting post-COVID. But as I say, I was the first in my family ever to get into the law. I certainly had no idea that I would become a government lawyer, and I don't think I would have known that such things existed when I first qualified. But one way or another, as I say, I got interested in the idea of law and policy and legislation and law as a tool in society and in governance, and having joined government in about 1989, I stayed there for over 30 years and had a great and very interesting career, which we may come on to.
Yeah, did you qualify as a solicitor or a barrister when you graduated?
I qualified as a barrister and went straight into government.
Did you ever think of going into private practice, or you were driven by your interest in policy into government?
I think it was all just a bit more accidental than that. I mean, having joined government, I didn't particularly expect to stay there. So I always thought, well, maybe I'll go into chambers, maybe I'll do something different. And then, 10 years later, 20 years later, there I still was. And I'd moved into different roles, as I say, of a kind that I didn't really know existed. I'd worked on legislation, I'd worked twice in the Attorney General's office. By then I had a management role and so on. So although if you'd asked me at the beginning, I probably would have imagined having a much more traditional career as a barrister in chambers, it just never happened. And I never regretted that, because I had a very interesting career doing what I did.
Should we talk a little bit about your time at the Attorney General's office? Obviously, the Attorney General is the senior legal advisor to the government, assisted by the Solicitor General. And the practice grew up, I think, particularly during Peter Goldsmith's time, that the Attorney General would regularly attend cabinet rather than just occasionally. But the Attorney General wasn't a cabinet minister. Could you just say something about the role of the Attorney General as you see it, and how you feel that role ought to be carried out? Because the Attorney General is a sort of slightly a slightly semi-detached figure from the government. Would you agree?
I would. I mean, it's a very unusual role. I had two spells in the Attorney General's office, once as a sort of relatively junior lawyer. I've worked with lots of law officers over the years. At that time, this would have been the late 90s, Nicholas Lyle was the Attorney General, and then we had the Labour government coming in. So John Morris then became attorney. So I had the experience then of, and at that point, to take your particular example, the attorney didn't sit in cabinet, was only a relatively rare attender when there were particular legal issues or attorney general issues that came up. And looking back, it feels now as though that was a kind of more traditional, old fashioned, if you like, model of the attorney. When I went back as head of the office, as you say, whenever that was, 2004 or thereabouts, Peter Goldsmith, Lord Goldsmith, was the attorney, began to attend cabinet much more frequently, as you say. And it felt then as if legal issues and the role of the attorney had become more central, and partly because that was Iraq was going on, and there was obviously the big issue around the legality of that. And since then, I've worked with successive attorneys, including Jeremy Wright and Geoffrey Cox and Dominic Grieve, and latterly Suella Braverman. And it is a very odd combination, that role, of both the political and the legal. And there are good reasons for that. There are good reasons why it makes sense to have a senior lawyer who is also a politician and is part of the government and is trusted and so on. But it does need somebody that can also be the dispassionate lawyer. And it needs somebody because some of the functions, as you will know, Ken, are public interest functions that are supposed to be exercised completely apolitically. So it does require somebody that is capable of balancing those two aspects to the role. And different attorneys have done that in different ways.
I suppose the risk of the more frequent, if not constant, attendance at cabinet and perhaps a sense in which the attorney is becoming closer to the political function carries the risk that unless the attorney has a robust sense of an independence alongside that, things could start to go slightly awry. After all, the attorney has to be prepared to tell the government things about the rule of law that the government doesn't want to hear.
Well, I agree with that. I think attendance at cabinet, in the end, I don't think that's necessarily the test, although it may be symbolic. I mean, it may make very good sense for a chief lawyer to be present at the meetings of the main, governance body of any organisation. But then what really matters is whether that person, as you say, can be sufficiently robust and give truly independent, dispassionate advice, can tell the client, in this case the government, things that the government may not want to hear, and can exercise those public interest functions in a way that is plainly independent of government and plainly independent of political interference. So that's the real test of that job, I think.
Yes, Jonathan, one thing that I think would be of interest to people listening to this, you've mentioned the concept of a client, the government as a client, and all of us who are lawyers understand the concept of privilege and legal professional privilege, which is the client's privilege, not therefore up to the lawyer to publish the advice that they're giving. I think a lot of people, and it's obviously given rise to controversy from Iraq and subsequently and before, obviously, Iraq, the attorney is giving legal advice to the government of the day. And people often then want to know, well, what is the advice? How far is this policy or is this decision truly in compliance with the advice that you've received? What's your view about that? Are you a believer in maintaining the strict confidentiality of the advice?
As a general rule, I am. As you probably know, there is, in addition to the normal rule of privilege, this separate rule around the confidentiality of law officers' advice, which is set out in the ministerial code. And that says that normally, even the fact of whether the attorney has advised is not disclosed. And there are good reasons for that. It's a kind of protection. It's almost a protection against the law officers being unduly drawn into politics. They become the center of the debate every time there is a row with any kind of legal element, that the law officers are wheeled out, as it were, to be the front line of defense. And that, I think, could be damaging and could unduly politicize legal advice. So there are good reasons for that rule, which is not an absolutely rigid rule, but it is the normal convention. But what that does require is that when the government is doing something that is legally contentious, Parliament and the public are entitled to know what the legal basis is for that. And very often it's likely to be tested sooner or later in the courts anyway. So the government does need to have a proper legal basis. And as has been done in the past, and as has been done in relation to the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, which we may come on to, the government has published a statement of its legal position, and people are entitled to interrogate that. They don't necessarily know, they don't see the text of the attorney's advice. They don't even necessarily know whether the attorney has advised, although in that case, it must be the case that she has. But then what matters is the substance, you know, is the legal basis for what's being done robust and credible. So I think there is a way of doing this that protects privilege, protects the confidential relationship between the law officers and government. But on the other hand, means that the government is ultimately accountable for the legality of particularly highly contentious decisions like that. And the same would be true of Iraq, where something similar happened.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, because it can cut both ways, can't it, in terms of creating problems. The decision not to reveal Peter Goldsmith's advice on the Iraq War was, it became a sort of running sore, didn't it? The issue just wouldn't go away because people wanted to know what the advice had been. Some people made mischief around it. People were speculating, and in a sense, the concealment of the advice became the issue, and it became politically very difficult, I think, for him at times.
I think that is true. There will always be occasions when advice has to come out, as it would always have done anyway. By the time you have a public inquiry like Chilcot, everything's going to have to come out. And of course, privilege can be waived and so on. So there's no absolute rule. And you're right in relation to Iraq, and I lived through that because I was in the office at the time. There was endless speculation about what advice had been given, had the advice been changed. You had Freedom of Information Act requests. And remember that under the FOI Act, the exemption for legal advice is only a qualified exemption. So even there is scope to argue that the public interest overrides what would normally be the rule of privilege. So as you say, that became a big issue. And then eventually, inevitably, part of the advice leaked. And once that starts happening, you have to disclose the whole thing, and that's what happened. And just what, you know, coming up to date with the Northern Ireland Protocol, Geoffrey Cox's advice, when he was Attorney General, was disclosed proactively. So there are two or three letters from Geoffrey Cox that were released to Parliament and the public, explaining his view on what the protocol did and didn't do. This is the version that was being negotiated under Theresa May. And that was proactively released to Parliament as an exception to the normal rule. But again, you know, for the same kind of reason, really, Ken, that, you know, the public interest and the parliamentary interest in knowing what was this legal deal that was being negotiated and what was the effect of it, that was thought to override the normal rule on on privilege and on disclosure of lawyers' advice, and I think there's probably good reason for that.
Yeah, and it seeps into everything. I mean, at one point we were even accused of dropping the Catherine Gunn case in order to protect the sanctity, the secrecy of Peter's advice, which was completely untrue. It was totally irrelevant to that decision. Let's just move forward a bit. I mean, I think, you know, whatever one's views about Brexit, it's clear that there was a period after the vote, during the early months, perhaps, of Boris Johnson's government, when a perception grew that the government was playing fast and loose with some of the constitutional rules, perhaps even with some aspects of the rule of law itself, and policies were followed, the legality of which were called into question. I mean, the proroguing of Parliament is an obvious example. Tell us what it was like being senior legal advisor, head of the government legal service at that time. I mean, what was it like for your staff? What was it like for you? What were the pressures? How did you cope with that?
Well, I mean, it's a long story. There's a lot to say. I mean, immediately after the referendum in 2016, I mean, this was, of course, was a huge kind of jolt for the civil service, as it was for the country. Most of us had not been expecting, however individuals voted, most of us had not been expecting a Leave vote. And famously, the civil service had not been allowed to prepare for a Leave vote, because the position of the Cameron government was that we were jolly well going to stay, and they were putting all their efforts into persuading the country to vote Remain. And there was really no contingency planning. So when we had the Leave vote, this was just a big, let's say, big jolt for the civil service. And we had to pivot again, whatever individuals thought. I'm sure there was the full range of emotions, and there was a lot of emotion, but we instantly had to pivot from a policy of staying in the EU to a policy of leaving. So that was a big institutional change, as much for lawyers as anybody else, because it became very clear that this was going to be a huge legal job, apart from anything else. But of course, at that point, we didn't have a template for what leaving meant. And in a way, the succeeding years was all about the political debate. Okay, we're going to leave, but what does leaving actually mean? What is the model? What relationship are we going to have with Europe? And that, as I say, became the massive political debate under Theresa May, and it was the debate in the end that saw her off. So, but it was our job as a civil service, including a legal service, to support the government as best we could. So we rapidly mobilised, we set up teams to do the legislation, to support the negotiations, to handle the litigation that inevitably came along. So there was a ton of work, but, you know, without being too kind of glib about it, we just sort of got on with it. And we may come on, so that the tensions that arose later, including the prorogation case, for example, emerged really when it became obvious that there was no agreed model for leaving that would command a majority in the House of Commons. And that's when you got the parliamentary shenanigans. That's when you got backbench bills being passed that forced the government to seek extensions of Article 50 and so on. And that's when things frankly did become legally messy.
Can I just ask you, Ken's question was posing, you know, the classic one of what do you do as a government legal advisor in the face of controversial legislation? And I think it might help people listening to understand what the process is. I mean, the Attorney General doesn't him or herself literally pick up a pen and give advice. The system involves going to counsel, to the Treasury panel of barristers. Can you say a little bit about that, and then also about circumstances in which, as it's been reported in the press, in relation to the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, the Rwanda policy issue, the government, Suella Braverman, has sought advice off panel. In other words, has sought advice from barristers who aren't on the panel.
Yeah. Well, as I've said, both just now and elsewhere, the one thing about Brexit was that it was always going to be a massively complicated legal exercise and constitutional exercise, just because of the complexity of the legal relationship with Europe, the complexity of the negotiations to get out, and the need to secure as much certainty and continuity as we could in domestic law. And that's why you had the Withdrawal Act and the Withdrawal Agreement Act and all the rest of it. So this was a huge legal challenge. And it was part of my job and my team's job to support that, overseen by the attorney. Successively, this was Jeremy Wright, then Jeffrey Cox, and latterly Suella Braverman have been the attorneys since 2016. And you're right, we do use external counsel, headed by First Treasury Counsel, that's James Eadie, but supported by these quite large panels of counsel, the A, B, and C panels, and they are all external barristers, nearly all barristers, there are a few solicitors, but nearly all barristers in private practice who go through a competitive process to be on the panels, and it's pretty rigorous. As I say, there are grades of panels, and people, if they're good enough, progress up the panels and so on from C to B to A. And those are the main sources of external advice to government. And the deal is really, nobody's guaranteed any work, but the deal is if you go through this effort to be on the panel, you're likely to be used. And only exceptionally will the government go off panel, as it's put, i.e. get advice from barristers who aren't on one of the panels. And that has to be approved by the attorney, by the law officers. The use of barristers not on the panels has to be approved by the law officers. And it is quite rare. It does happen. If you need advice from a silk, so apart from James Eadie, panels are junior barristers, not QCs. If you want to go to QC, which is not that unusual for big cases, but you have to get the approval of the attorney for it. And equally, if you want to go to an expert, a particular specialist, maybe an area that's not well represented on the panels, again, you might go off panel and that has to be approved. But this is all overseen by the attorney. And it follows that if the attorney wants to go to an external barrister, they can basically go to whoever they want. And I'm not there now, but my understanding is that the attorney, Suella Braverman, has sought advice from people who are not on the panels. And I said, there's nothing, you know, this does happen. But what really matters is who, and we don't necessarily know who. And ultimately, of course, what's the quality of the advice that is being given? And I mean, again, I haven't seen the underlying advice. I, like many others, have been very unpersuaded by the legal explanation that the government's given for the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. And what has leaked suggests that James Eadie was a bit unpersuaded by the bits that he saw. So there is a bit of an issue about the quality of the advice that's been sought. And if what's happened is that, as you put it, Tim, the attorney has kind of lawyer shopped to get convenient advice, which most lawyers wouldn't agree with, then I don't think that's doing a service to anybody, including parliamentarians who, you know, are apparently relying on the government's assertion that what's being done is lawful. And if that's being done on the basis of very flaky advice, then that's not very good for anybody.
I mean, I think this is actually quite serious, isn't it? I mean, we don't know anything really about this advice or where it came from, and it no doubt it's possible it was perfectly decent, independent advice. I'm not suggesting otherwise, but if it were to be the position that the law officers were opinion shopping, if you like, if the Attorney General started going to people who she thought would give a particular view, that would be a very undesirable development, wouldn't it? Because the whole strength of the panel system is that you have a group of assessed experts who are independent of government, who are giving rigorous, legal, independent advice that isn't in any way party pre. And to move away from using people on that panel without very good reason seems to me to create some very obvious risks in terms of the robustness and independence of the system.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, going to a lawyer just because you think they'll tell you a particular answer is always a bad idea, isn't it? Because you go to a lawyer because you want them to tell you the right answer. And of course, lawyers may disagree. That's a different point. But you don't choose your lawyer because you think they will just give, particularly if you know that answer is likely to be, you know, it's convenient to you, but not shared by many others in the profession. You're just picking the one lawyer that will tell you the convenient thing. That would be very bad, whoever your client was. And there must be some suspicion that is what has happened. In the end, it's the Attorney General who has to own the advice, because the Attorney General, under our system, is the chief legal advisor to government. So we don't see her advice we're not technically told whether she has advised, but it is, of course, unthinkable that she hasn't on an issue of this magnitude, and given anyway the very public position she's taken on the protocol. So in the end, it's the attorney who must own this advice, whoever she has consulted outside. She is the chief legal advisor to government, and she must be prepared to defend the position that the government has taken legally, which, as I say, I've personally found unpersuasive.
You worked with Suella Braverman. You also worked with Dominic Grieve. And I suppose in one sense, they make a contrast, they had a contrasting styles and obviously contrasting positions. And did you find her a particularly politicized attorney general, as many people seem to suggest? I mean, there is this perception of her that she's rather captured politically, and that she's very much part of the Johnsonian project. First of all, did you find that? And if you did, do you think that's desirable in an attorney general, to be captured in that way?
I try not to over-personalize this.
Okay, I understand.
And I'll do my best. I mean, in fact, I didn't actually work for Suella Braverman for that long, because she was appointed sort of early-ish 2020, and then we went into lockdown because of COVID, and by September of 2020, I had resigned. So actually, we didn't sort of, and a lot of that time, as I say, we were in lockdown. So, you know, my sort of personal relationship with her was relatively limited. But, and it's obvious that in the end, we disagreed, because she took a position on what was then the Internal Market Bill, which I thought was completely wrong, indefensibly wrong.
You felt that the decisions she was making, again, I presume, on legal advice, was in effect to deliberately go on a path to breach international law.
Yeah, at that stage, the government acknowledged that what they were doing breached international law in a, quote, limited and specific way. Mm. And I'm not giving away any confidences here, because the attorney herself stood up more than once in Parliament and said that and defended it. And I thought that was indefensible, and it was an incoherent position to take. It's not the same as the position that government is now taking, by the way. Government is now saying that it's not breaching international law, whereas in 2020 their position was that they were, but that it was okay constitutionally. So I disagreed with that. I think, to answer your question, Ken, I think there is no doubt that the attorney is very, very closely aligned to the political project of the government, in particular Brexit. I mean, let's be honest, all of this government, all of the cabinet, were are true faith Brexiteers. Theresa May had a go at maintaining a government that had a mixture of views, including some Remainers, who you had to sign up to the government policy that we were now leaving, but had historically been Remainers. This government has no such people. All of those people have now gone. And the sort of David Gawkes and Liddingtons and all those people, and indeed Dominic Grieve himself, they're now out. So this government is a government of true believers in Brexit. Suella Braverman is certainly part of that. And she has a history, as we know, in the ERG and so on, of as a Brexit a DEXU minister. So she is very, very close to that. And she's also much more vocal in the media and so on than most of her predecessors, both in propagating the Brexit course, in defending the protocol bill, in the need to amend the protocol, and in other aspects like the need to reform judicial review and in the fact that the courts have gone too far. So she's been, in that sense, she's been a much more public and, I would say, political attorney general, yes.
And then, of course, there's a parallel with what happened in America under another populist leader in Trump, where the office of attorney general under Bill Barr became identified with the Trump project. I mean, it's a very disturbing trend, isn't it, for this particular office?
I think it's a problem. I mean, whether things have gone quite that far, you know, I don't know. But I think if we now have people that, whether you disagree with it or not, and there will always be disagreement about contentious legal issues, the idea that an attorney general's position is not taken seriously as a robust, strong defender of the rule of law and a provider of independent advice, with which, as I say, people may disagree, but nonetheless, I think if the role is sort of now dismissed as being, well, it's just another politician saying what's convenient to the government of the day, then that is very damaging. You sort of then begin to ask, what's the point of the job?
I mean, you may not say it, but I will. That's clearly what's happened? I mean, it's clearly the case that certainly a large proportion of the legal profession have that perception that the Attorney General is not giving the government robust, independent legal advice, but is part of a project. And I think that's, as you say, a very undesirable development. Because if the Attorney General is not standing up for the rule of law in cabinet meetings, who is? We don't have a Lord Chancellor anymore. We have Secretaries of State for Justice who are obviously political figures in a way that perhaps the Lord Chancellor wasn't always. So who is standing up for the rule of law in cabinet? It seems as though nobody is.
Before we move on to another subject, while we're still on looking, for example, at the Northern Ireland Protocol bill, the defence, the government's defence, is the doctrine of necessity. So in other words, it's justified to break the withdrawal agreement and thereby to depart from an international law obligation because Britain, the United Kingdom, and specifically Northern Ireland, is facing a grave and urgent peril. What's your view about that?
Well, I don't believe it. I don't think it's right. And I don't think it's right on the evidence for a start. I mean, the government has produced no evidence for what this grave and imminent peril is. The Foreign Secretary was asked this yesterday in the House of Commons by Bob Neill and just gave a non-answer. I mean, there is no evidence. I mean, I just don't believe. I mean, there's a political row in Northern Ireland, but I don't believe there's societal breakdown. And certainly the figures on the trading impact of Northern Ireland suggest Northern Ireland's doing all right, actually, out of the protocol. So I just don't believe it. And it does frankly beggar belief that this agreement that was signed just a couple of years ago, presented as a great negotiating triumph, obviously made very difficult, controversial choices, but they were choices the government made willingly and rejoiced in at the time, that this has now gone so catastrophically wrong that we're now facing a position of grave and imminent peril, plus the point that international law requires this to be a last resort. And it seems to me that it's been a kind of first resort. There's been no attempt to rely on Article 16, for example, controversial though that would be. That would allow lesser measures to be taken to prevent the kind of disruption that the government says. And then there's finally the point of whether this is truly imminent. The threat is so urgent that the government is nonetheless prepared to fight over a controversial bill, which will take months and months to get through Parliament, probably is quite likely to be savaged in the House of Lords. I hope it is. But that as a solution to an imminent threat, just I find completely incredible. As do most commentators. I mean, it so happens that Robert Buckland, the former Lord Chancellor, has said he believes it. So, you know, there it is. I think that's a minority view.
It seems to me to be a completely cynical smokescreen, really. It just gives them a justification for what they feel they need to do politically. But it's disturbing that legal figures in the government are going along with it, because it's very difficult to see how they have managed to persuade themselves that this is the legal reality. Before we move on to current legislation, which I know Tim is particularly keen to ask you some questions about, can we just deal with the big issue of your resignation, Jonathan, and what led to it and how it panned out?
Yes, I mean, it's one thing anybody's ever heard about me is that I resigned.
I don't think that's true.
I have talked about it elsewhere. But I mean, much of this we've now talked about, which is that, you know, as a government lawyer and as a senior lawyer in government, you get used to dealing with controversial cases. You get used to giving advice, which is very often based on legal risk, that something may be vulnerable to challenge or may be the wrong side of the law. But provided there are respectable arguments, the government is entitled to take the risk, and then the government legal department will defend them. And if they lose, in the end, they will comply with the judgment. And that's, you know, part of the rough and tumble of the law and of politics. And I certainly saw plenty of that. What arose on the internal market bill was of a different order. There you had a government, and not in a minor, you know, trivial way or technical way, was prepared in a big, public, controversial way to legislate, to bring forward legislation that would have breached our international law commitments. And again, not some obscure corner of an ancient treaty, but, you know, a core of one of the Brexit instruments agreed with the EU only at that stage, a matter of months before. So that was a big problem for the law. And then, as I've said, the justification given for that, which was an acceptance, yes, this did break international law, but it was okay to do it because Parliament is sovereign, I found, well, fatuous, really. I mean, it was just sort of didn't deal with the problem. So, and I did my best internally to persuade people that this wasn't a good idea, but such was the politics of the time, you know, in the end, I failed to persuade people. I suppose with the possible exception of Lord Keane, then the Advocate General for Scotland, who shared my concerns and did in the end, a little later, resign. But we were, you know, so that there it was. And I just reached the end of my tether, that I thought this was wrong, really fundamentally wrong. And to go back to an earlier point, my sort of relationship with the attorney by then, I mean, not my personal relationship, we were cordial enough, but the idea that I could thereafter work with the Attorney General, with whom I disagreed so profoundly on a rule of law question, I'd reached the end of the line. So
her position, of course, was that it was appropriate in these circumstances for the United Kingdom to break international law.
Yes. I mean, so she said it was constitutionally proper, which is just an assertion. It's just sort of saying, well, if we want to break the law, we can, and we'll just decide.
Not a great recipe for a rules-based international order.
It completely blows up the idea of a rules-based international order if one state can just decide when it's appropriate to break a treaty.
Jonathan, there is a vacancy as the government's ethics advisor. I just wondered if you'd thought of applying for the job.
Well, I'm not sure I'd be very welcome.
You'd be welcome to us.
You might be famous for resigning twice within record time.
I'm not even sure if they want to fill the vacancy. Well, I think this is just another example of a government that doesn't really like rules applying to it or external scrutiny. So anyway, that's another problem.
Perhaps we can move on, as Ken indicated. We'd like to just raise with you some questions about the recently published Bill of Rights Bill. I mean, we're recording this at the end of June, and it, just over a week ago, the government published the Bill of Rights Bill. It seeks to repeal and replace the Human Rights Act, lock, stock and barrel. The UK remains a party to the convention, and the rights covered by the bill are the same, and there's still a duty on public authorities to act consistently with convention rights, and they will still be enforceable in the UK courts, but the whole procedure for applying, interpreting and enforcing those rights, as you've said in a very helpful briefing paper that Linklaters have published, all of that is going to be dramatically changed. I mean, I won't go through each clause one by one, but the biggest headlines, I suppose, is that courts are no longer required to interpret domestic legislation compatibly with convention rights so far as possible. They're no longer required to take decisions of the European Court of Human Rights into account. The bill will prevent UK courts from interpreting convention rights in a way which imposes new positive obligations on public authorities. And it assumes by clause 7 that UK courts must treat Parliament as having decided that an act of Parliament has struck the appropriate balance between competing factors. That's in effect going to get rid of, or the intention is to get rid of, the proportionality test, I think. And then most significantly, specifically on Article 8, the government intends to set the bar in relation to deportation cases of persons who committed criminal offences, to set the bar so high as to make it almost impossible for a court to prevent a deportation. So with that package, and as a former head of the government legal service, how do you see the future in terms of legal certainty, decision-making, and so on?
Well, so first of all, I think it is a very big change, albeit, as you say, that the actual package of rights remains the same. It goes much further than the government's own independent review recommended. The independent review under Peter Cross really didn't, I think, suggest anything major by way of legislation. I think this was suggested that things could be done around communication and presentation and relationships with Strasbourg and so on.
Did it gave it a sort of pretty much a comprehensive seal of approval that the Act was working well and the courts were appropriately deferring and balancing rights and so on.
And of course, a lot of the case law had sort of settled down and had developed over the years since 98. So this goes further than any of that, and it is a substantial rewriting of the 98 Act. And it seems to me it is intended to, bluntly, make it more difficult for people to enforce their rights in the UK courts. And that goes back to the point I mentioned that some of the comments that Suella Braverman has made have been around the courts going too far in judicial review, but also human rights cases, in interfering in basically political decisions which should be matters for the government and parliament. And there are some specific examples in the bill around, as you say, around Article 8 and deportation cases. The overall effect of this bill, I think, is intended to be to redress that balance, to rein the courts in a bit, make it more difficult to bring a case in the first place. And one of the other effects of the bill is to create a requirement for permission to bring a human rights claim. And then once it gets to court, if you get permission, then the courts are told to have less regard to Strasbourg, not to expand the interpretation of any right, except if they're sure that Strasbourg would do so, and to give the greatest possible weight to the views of Parliament. So that's what this is about. It's reining in the courts. It's telling them not to go off on a frolic of their own, as if that's what they've been doing up to now, and to pay the greatest possible respect to Parliament and to interpret particular rights in particular circumstances in a very restricted way. And that seems, I don't think that's sort of controversial, that seems to be what the government wants, is that fewer cases will be brought and fewer cases will succeed.
Yeah, but isn't the fundamental incoherence about this whole proposal is that the reality is the government would like to withdraw from the convention, but doesn't feel that politically it's possible. And so it isn't doing that. It's repealing the Human Rights Act, but then creating a set of new tests and approaches to the enforcement of convention rights, which is inevitably going to bring the UK into conflict with Strasbourg in future decisions. But they haven't got the guts to just leave the convention system. I mean, do you think that's fair?
I think that is fair. I mean, I think we've seen, and obviously there's a certain amount of conflation with Brexit and the relationship with the EU. But what you have in common is the idea that a government and enough of Parliament do not like the idea of being told what to do by any international or foreign organisation, and in particular by any foreign court. And that's part of this sort of visceral hatred of the European Court of Justice, which has infected the protocol. So one of the things people hate about the Northern Ireland Protocol is that the ECJ has a role under that. And I think we see something similar with the Council of Europe, because again, what you've got is the government signed up to a very long-standing treaty, and therefore rules which are, as it were, imposed on us by an international organization. And it's part of the, as we all know, it's part of the convention that the rules are ultimately overseen and enforced by the European Court of Human Rights. So for a certain part of the political class, you've got this same problem that the UK is subject to this international or foreign body of rules. And to make matters worse, it's overseen by a foreign court. But all of that is inherent in the ECHR. That's the deal. It's always been the deal, including, of course, the right of individual petition to Strasbourg. And so long as we're part of the ECHR, that's the deal. Those are our international law obligations. And I agree, this bill is I think, an attempt that's destined to fail, ultimately, to find a way of bringing the same rights under the sole control of the UK Parliament and the UK courts, as if we were no longer members. But of course we are, and therefore none of this can stop individuals going off to Strasbourg if they lose in the UK courts, and if the bill succeeds, probably more people will lose in the UK courts. Those people, if they can be bothered and have the money, will go off to Strasbourg, and the bill can't stop that. And the bill can't stop Strasbourg applying the ECHR as it interprets it. And therefore, the possibility must be that some of those people who've lost in the UK courts will win in Strasbourg. And the government will have no choice but to honour those rulings, because that's what the convention requires, in which case, what's the whole point of this bill? Or it will have to decide to defy them, in which case it's putting itself in breach of the convention. So in the end, the bill, to that extent, the bill, if that's what happens, the bill will not really have worked.
I mean, this is a sort of, I think on the part of the government, a sort of UK exceptionalism, a bit like US exceptionalism. I mean, the United States doesn't allow itself to be governed in any way by foreign courts and won't join those sorts of institutions. Famously, they're not part of the International Criminal Court arrangements. And I think people like Dominic Raab fundamentally feel the same about Britain. You know, they think, you know, the UK is the home of rights, the home of democracy, the home of the common law. We don't need foreign courts telling us what to do. And I think if they felt they could withdraw from the convention, they would. But they've got some serious practical difficulties, haven't they? I mean, the Good Friday Agreement, for a start, would make it very difficult for us to leave that system. And I think the devolution settlement also would. So I think this is probably more a case of them feeling it's not possible for them, for various reasons, to leave. And therefore, they're trying to have the best of both worlds. It's another example of sort of Johnsonian cakeism. We'll stay in Strasbourg, but we'll try and limit its influence on our procedures as much as possible, short of what we really want to do, is which is to actually leave.
Well, I think there's probably a lot in that. I mean, and this may be, you know, from the government's point of view, enough for now. I mean, it's been promising a reform of the Human Rights Act for, well, many years. It's certainly been a project of Dominic Raab's to repeal or amend the HRA. And it may be that this kind of fairly radical reform, whilst remaining in the ECHR, is kind of enough to satisfy that particular appetite in the Tory party and in Parliament for now, without, as you say, being prepared to bite the bullet, and I hope they never do bite it, of leaving the ECHR with all the political pain and the domestic complexity that would create.
Do you think there's an argument, nevertheless, that since we have, I know the ECHR has got nothing to do with the EU, but since we have left the EU and since we're apparently forging this new world of global Britain, that it's appropriate to have a British Bill of Rights, which Parliament approves and which is homegrown? Do you think there's an argument that that actually is a reasonably healthy development if it's done in the right way?
Well, I don't think this bill is that, because it doesn't, despite all the protestations, it doesn't add any new rights. There's nothing really distinctively British about it. It's the same set of rights. A particular weight is to be given to the right to freedom of speech and so on, but you know, it's basically the same Article 10 right. And there's this rather pointless reference to jury trial, which says you've got a right to jury trial so long as the law grants you one. And we all know that most criminal trials are not jury trials. So the attempt to add, as I've said somewhere, a kind of British flavour to this, I think has failed. And in a way, that's, to go back to your point, Ken, that is what is going to happen so long as we remain party to an international convention with many of those rights now well embedded in UK law anyway, and reflecting what would be the common law anyway. That's part of what the independent review found. So this is the attempt, is to produce something that feels a bit more British because it's got references to the UK courts and Parliament. But the guts of it is still ECHR.
Yeah, I was involved in some discussions with people from the Free Speech Union about this bill before it was published. And interestingly, that the main concern of the group involved in this discussion was that the British Bill of Rights should contain at least as much support for free speech as Article 10 has been able to deliver. So it's quite interesting that a group of people who wouldn't naturally be thought of as supporters of the EU were recognising in their conversations the huge benefits that aspects of the European Convention had brought us domestically, and indeed were invoking those benefits in their submission to the government. You know, don't do us down. We must have at least as much free speech protection as all those people in Europe have. I thought that was quite interesting, actually.
Well, that may be, aside from the press interest we know about, that may be what has led to the particular weight that is given to free speech in the bill. But as I say, it's not an attempt to amend Article 10, because we couldn't do that so long as we're parties to the ECHR. So what difference it will make remains to be seen.
Yeah, and you're right. And the jury trial provision is just, well, it's almost comical. It's like a little stamp that's been stuck in there just to make the point that there's something British about all of this. It's a bit pathetic, really.
It has no legal effect at all.
Well, the free speech clause is not terribly impressive. It simply says something about judges giving paramount importance to free speech, which I suppose is intended to be an advance on a balancing exercise between, for example, free speech and privacy. I suppose that's what they're intending to do by that clause, but whether it'll have any impact at all is another matter.
Well, as you're right, if it does have an impact, it can only ultimately be at the expense of some other right, like the right to privacy. And that clause, a lot of this bill is very complex, but there's a complex set of caveats to that clause, which says that, for example, it's not to apply in the interpretation of any criminal offence. So if the government criminalises something that might otherwise impinge on freedom of expression, like the right to protest, for example, then the obligation to give great weight to the right to freedom of speech doesn't apply in that situation. So, you know, it's a pretty complicated set of balancing exercises that the bill does, and it remains to be seen, as you say, whether it does make any difference.
Yeah, you're right. It's very heavily hedged. Well, Jonathan, that's been a fascinating discussion. I wonder how are you feeling about the future? I mean, are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? Do you think things are going to get better, worse? Do you think this is all to do with the Johnson government, or do you think they've shifted the dial and we're going to be living with the consequences of some of this, even if there is a change in government?
Well, personally, I have, as they say, moved on, and I've been out of government now. Well, it is almost 2 years. And I'm happily engaged elsewhere. But of course, I'm still following this debate because it's important and it's professionally of interest to me. And just at the moment, I'm not hugely optimistic because yesterday the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill had its second reading, and it felt very much as if we were sort of circling the same drain, really, in terms of, you know, Brexit is not done. We are proposing to break international law. We do not have a stable relationship with the EU, and this bill is certainly not going to help create one. So there's still a lot to, you know, maybe we just have to accept this is going to take years.
Neither the Bill of Rights Bill nor the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill were manifesto commitments. So, Ken, it's going to be up to you in the House of Lords to do as much damage as possible to this legislation.
Well, I think their lordships will get very busy on this legislation and no doubt suffer more abuse in certain quarters for doing so. But this is going to be very, very controversial stuff in the House of Lords. I've no doubt about that. Although, of course, we do now have more Brexiteers in the House of Lords than we used to. But I think the Lords is still a pretty Ramone-y kind of place. and I do think there'll be some fierce debates about this, as of course there should be.
The government is entitled to, you know, it's entitled to amend the Human Rights Act. It's entitled to have a policy on those things. But I think some of these issues do cross a line. I certainly think the protocol bill does. And I hope, again, whatever one's politics, that the House, I hope you in the House of Lords, you know, give it a good going over, basically.
Yeah, I think you can be confident about that. Well, Jonathan, it's been an enormous pleasure. I must say, speaking for myself, I'd be a lot more confident about the future if you were still head of the government legal service. But alas, those days have gone. And I just hope that people in government in Whitehall who are responsible for protecting the rule of law begin to do it, because if they don't, then I think, you know, as you say, I think you used a very evocative phrase, we'll continue to circle the same drain.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us, Jonathan.
Thanks, Jonathan, as well. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I do hope that you'll come back and speak to us on future occasions when there are issues that your expertise would be very helpful in illuminating. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Double Jeopardy with me, Ken McDonald, and with me, Tim Owen. Our producer and editor is Billy Lawrence. Do join us next week for a fascinating discussion with Professor Kathleen Stock, the distinguished philosopher who was hounded out of her job at Sussex University last year for her views on transgender rights and gender identity. And thank you all for listening to this first episode of what we plan to be a weekly podcast series. You can find Double Jeopardy at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all major platforms, and our Twitter handle, Double Jeopardy Pod. If you want to leave us a review, please don't hold back. Good reviews will help others to find us and join the audience. And goodbye for now.